question to answer like it should be answered, because at that time, see, this was in 43, the waves were not established until late 1942.
Right.
And it really didn't get off the ground till a little bit later. And the war effort was, you know, goodness, in its peak, I guess you would say, almost. Maybe not the peak, because it kept escalating because of the way things were going in Europe. And of course, after Pearl Harbor, that's what really got this country going strong, gung-ho. Well, they already were, of course, but still, it galvanized the
country,
whole country.
Right.
Yeah. And so I guess I had finished college. I'd gotten and I'd done graduate work.
Where did you study?
Degree. I studied so many places. I'm one of those people that traveled to colleges, you know. First, I went to a girls' school, Ward Belmont, in Nashville, Tennessee, which is no longer in existence because a wonderful, wonderful school. But after World War II, everything changed and girls' schools weren't the thing to do anymore, you know. But still, I wouldn't take anything for that experience because it was really a good school. And that was in Nashville. I was grew up in Glasgow, Kentucky, which is only, you know, less than 2 hours from Nashville. And I had a cousin who taught there, and my sister had also taught there, so it was a good place to go. And then got my AB at Transylvania.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, I wasn't ready to, I was 19 at the time, and so what are you going to do when you're 19 and you don't have any, you know, this was, you know, quite a while ago.
Yes, absolutely.
And what did you do? Teach, be a nurse. Well, actually.
Or be a mom.
Or be a mom, yeah. Well, none of which really was in my thinking right then. So my dad said, okay, you got to go to Western and get your education. You know, that was. So that settled that. So I went to Western for a few months to get this.
Western Kentucky.
Western Kentucky University, yeah. When I say Western, I think everybody knows Western, you know. anyway, that was just the must, that was all. And so then I did, because the country at that time, they were desperate for teachers, and they called me one morning when I was...
Who called you?
The school there. Well, I'll have to explain. Yeah. In Glasgow. And they were desperate for teachers. Here they were, 8 o'clock in the morning, no teachers. Could you please, please come teach? Just do some substitute.
And you were 19. This is when you were 19.
Yeah. I guess I, well, I probably had
after
a birthday
Western?
By then.
It
was probably, you know, I was probably 20 by then. But anyway, you know, what can you say? And here was my mother, who had been a teacher, you know, thinking, well, surely she will. And so I did. But what happened then, of course, that happened every day.
Uh-huh.
So for, I guess, about 8 months, I taught. Then, and actually, see, my majors, I had, by that time, see, I'd collected several. I had 3 majors, in one in history and English and art education.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So did I say this? I had gone to Peabody and gotten my master's.
Okay.
And
your master's in?
In art education.
Okay.
And they had a very good program there, which was, it wasn't, you did studio art. Well, they'd had such a good program at Ward Belmont that that was my introduction into the art world, really. Well, my mother had been an artist, so I can't say that it was my introduction, because it wasn't, because I'd grown up with her, doing all that she could at that time about inspiring you in that respect. But public schools then, of course, small public schools like Glasgow, there was no training like that.
Okay.
So Ward Belmont was great. It was terrific because it had a wonderful art department, and I loved it.
And was that a high school,
Ward Belmont? Well, Ward Belmont was started in middle school, started in and boarding school. See, this was a boarding school.
In Glasgow?
No, this was in Nashville.
Okay,
I'm sorry. Nashville, Tennessee. And then it went on through junior college. So I took work there after I'd graduated from high school in Glasgow. Anyway, well, as I told you, my educational experience wasn't
wide and varied.
It wasn't real wide at that time, but it was very, you know, from Nashville to Lexington isn't that far, and Glasgow. But anyways, it was good. And my parents, of course, encouraged it all the time, so that was because.
So were you teaching then when you decided to?
Well, that was when, yes, because, you know, what we would do, and this was wartime, all you could do, you're sitting down here in a small town, rural, agricultural area, and only thing I could, and you wanted to be contributing, because that was the way everybody felt.
Yeah.
Bundles for Britain, we knitted, you know. Well, knitting, you'd go to the movie and knit, you know, that's fine, but that. And then, too, I had gone to, Curtis Wright was building planes in Louisville, and I'd gone up there because they painted the planes. And this cousin who lived with us, literally, and he was wonderful, and he'd gotten an interview for me. And so I went up there to see about this. And
with the plane?
To paint planes. You know, see, the insignia, they had to paint.
Needed
the insignia.
An artist.
And they needed an artist. And see, I was always looking for the art world. And so I got there and I talked to him and I thought, yeah, but, you know, this is okay, but there ought to be more out there, you know. And so then all of a sudden I saw in the paper, Career Journal, that's our big paper, you see. And, well, New York Times, we got the New York Times. Not every day we got the Sunday edition, but that was great. And this came out in the paper that this was happening. Mildred McAfee, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, they recognized, as it's mentioned there, that the need, and that there were a lot of women out there that could do many, many jobs that would. And the purpose, of course, was to release a man for
active duty. To be able to go
duty.
Overseas, yeah.
Now, don't misunderstand me. We were on active duty.
Absolutely.
So it wasn't exactly. Well, so anyway, I thought, okay, this sounds like something that's going to be good. Now, the WACS had already been established.
And that's the Army Corps.
That's the Army Corps. Mm-hmm. And in Britain, of course, they had, you know, the Air Corps there. The women were in the Air Corps there, because that was a whole different ballgame, because this country was still, women weren't
involved as much. But
no, absolutely not. Yeah. Now, the WACS, you could get in the WACS. That was, yeah, sure.
Women's.
But that wasn't really what appealed to me. So when I saw this, I, you know, wrote to find out more about it. And then, you know, with the information I got, found out that I could apply for Officer Candidate School. And our region where we were to go to be tested was Indianapolis. That was the region we were included in. And so I got all set up for that and went to Indianapolis. And that was a 2-day experience.
The tests, but, or just the whole
tests,
thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The test. Oh, yeah. Well,
going and they to were written tests?
Oh, yeah. You had written tests for 2 days, and then you had interviews with a naval officer.
A male.
So
was it nerve-wracking? Or did you enjoy it?
Well, at
was
that
it
time, it wasn't, you know, no, it didn't affect me as being nerve-wracking.
Okay.
But now this was the thing I'll have to tell you, because I know my mother was, see, my dad had been, well, he was a medical officer in World War I. And I think that must have transmitted something to me, because he'd talk about it after a long period of time. And I've discovered that that's simply the way it is, I think.
That people wait and
the experience. You don't want to talk about it.
Right away, and it takes a long, many years before you want to talk about it.
And so when Daddy was talking about it, and he served overseas in France and during World War I now, but then just before World War II, he got a group of veterans there in Glasgow. Mother had them all out for dinner one night, and I don't know if that affected me or not, but I think all those things affect you, and you're not conscious of it, you know. But
and of course, this was while World War II was going on.
Yes,
that this
it was right before.
Oh, right before
before it happened. But
before Pearl Harbor?
Before Pearl Harbor. But there was still this feeling that, you know, they wanted to get together and tell their stories, which was, you know, that I thought, well, this is terrific, you know. And I always felt a great deal of pride, I guess. See, we grew up when schools were very patriotic, and small towns especially. And, you know, you had all these special days, like Memorial Day, and you had everybody. In fact, they still do it in Glasgow. They have a much better attendance than when I've been to it here.
A parade or something?
Oh, yeah.
A Memorial Day parade?
And then, too, for a long period of time, see, Armistice Day, they called it.
Mm-hmm. No, and that's when?
That was November the 11th. Mm-hmm. See, that, because that was the end of War One, and so they would celebrate it, you know. And we still, even years, in fact, actually, almost, and they probably still do it until I moved up here about 6 years ago. We'd have the Veterans Day, of course, now.
Right.
The Veterans Day Parade, and it's a big affair. You know, that's a big deal.
And in Glasgow.
Gosh, we'd put on, oh, yeah. And by that, and it's real interesting to me, looking at it today, to recognize that the people my age, am I going into this detail too much? Stop me.
Well,
yes.
You might be. We should probably move
I
along
think so.
A little. It's very interesting.
I'm telling
but
you, but yeah, this gets much. Yeah, okay. Stop me anytime.
Okay.
You know, because I...
Okay,
these
well,
are
so
just off the top of my head.
Okay, well,
so
tell me a little bit more then about the process you had started to go
all right,
into
skip
when you
this
went to
other.
Indianapolis.
Yeah, okay, well, this real nice fellow interviewed me, you know, and I thought, well, okay, you know, if I get it, it's fine. If I don't, there's something else out there. You don't have to. It's not the only thing in the world, but it's what I really wanted, because, see, as I finished my undergraduate college work, was when War II started. And a lot of my friends, practically, I mean, I guess all of them in college, and a lot of them that I had grown up with were going off to the war. And
your girlfriends
various
and
places.
your fellow friends.
Fellows,
okay.
Because girls, no.
Yeah, okay.
There wasn't anywhere for them to go much, right. You know, and the girls. But all the fellows were gone. And so you were really a part of it, because you'd talk to them, you'd get letters from them, and the real awful, horrible things that were happening. You know, the landings in North Africa, and then when they were sent out, just these fellows just barely out of school.
Young kids.
Young kids. Mm-hmm. And hardly any 8 weeks of training, you know, or something like that. Just nothing. And going out just to be mowed down, which they were. And that just really, that got me. So that was what really, really did it to me when, you know, you know.
You really felt the patriotic urge to.
Yeah, yeah.
Participate.
And when you get the message that this one has died, this mm-hmm. one got shot down going across North Africa, this destroyer was hit landing in. Now, this was, see, back in when we first were in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, going, you know, when they made the landings in Italy and all that. Now, I know I'm going into too much detail on all this, but
that's, okay.
that's what was so strong to me. Because this was, you know, real. This was real. And when we talk about, we call it sacrifices. I mean, today they say the sacrifices you made at home.
Yes.
Well, it was, you know, it wasn't that bad. And that sounds funny, I guess, to say that. But, you know, no tires, no cars, no sugar, no gas. Those things were immaterial because, you know, there was this other that was...
more important.
Well, much more important.
And everybody knew that.
And these were friends and that weren't coming back. So that was the real thing that, you know, you think, well, gosh, you got to do what you can. So anyway, that was.
But then you.
Oh, my motivation, I guess.
So you passed those initial exams and interviews.
Yeah, but you see, at the same time, and I've got a copy of this write-up that was written about that time about Mildred McAfee. Now, I tell you, I certainly...
And she was a lieutenant commander of the Waves.
Of the Waves.
Yes.
And see, she... Now, this is my interpretation, and I got it from this article and from being serving there in that outfit. When she came in, she was president of Wellesley, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted somebody that was...
smart.
Smart, capable, and... had the ability to do what had to be done.
Yeah.
But, and see, that was for us fortunate because we weren't treated like these women in, and I don't know if it's written up in that or not, but I have a friend here in Lexington who was in the women's group who were ferrying planes, and they were training, training pilots also. Now, this was even before the Waves was established or thought about. And they were treated, actually...
was this with the
I
Navy?
I would say, no. This was... No,
no
it
not,
was
not
just
Navy
a group.
Planes, just...
It was not... they were training, yes, for the Air Corps.
Okay.
But they weren't recognized. And to me, that's been... most disgraceful because they had and I can't give you the exact figures, but two or three pilots who were killed, they had to even pay to send them back to their home. I mean,
women pilots that were killed.
The women pilots, yeah. So I'm just comparing it to, right. See, this happened before because, and they were finally, Congress never gave them even identity as a group, as a part of
right.
the air.
You're talking about the WAX.
I'm talking about, no.
No.
They didn't even have a name. The WAX was different.
Okay.
See,
so
that
not,
was under...
That was under the Army.
Under the Army. And they were... Eisenhower, I presume... Now, I don't know that much about the WAX, but I presume he was...
Well, they were not considered part of the Army either. They were with the Army. But
well,
the Waves were a part of
we
the...
We were a part of the Naval Reserve.
Right.
We're... It said Women's Active Volunteer Emergency Service, USNR, United States Naval Reserve. And that's who we were. And I'm sure that Mildred McAfee was the one that was responsible, that she was coming in on her terms. And she was, and we were, and it was written out that we got the same rank as the man.
And the same pay?
The same pay as the men. When we reported, when we had a problem,
mm-hmm.
we went to the, not Mildred McAfee, but each group, wherever you were stationed, had a commander that was, that you went to
mm-hmm.
with a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness.
Right.
because really the men, and you know, that's understandable. Mm-hmm. They, a lot of them didn't want you around. They were not going, you know.
Right.
That's understandable, but you did have that avenue. So, so that was good. So anyway, I went to Northampton. They had.
That's Northampton, Massachusetts.
Yes,
it's
Smith.
And that's where Smith College is.
Right.
And
see,
the Navy sort of took that over. They took over part of Smith College
they took
and the
over
Northampton Hotel.
Anything they wanted to. Yes, yes. And, yeah, it was at Smith. And so we were there for training for 3 months.
Tell me about your arrival there. Were you excited? Did you get off the train with load of other women?
Well, there wasn't a load because, see, I was coming from Kentucky. I think... And I'm not sure about this. I think I was about the second person in Kentucky to go. I think there was somebody from Louisville that had gone in. But it was pretty early still because I got to Northampton in June. And see, they just really...
June of 43.
Mm-hmm. And it just really...
Was just getting
beginning
rolling.
To happen, mm-hmm. Yeah. Because they were still, you know, working on it. And, of course, getting recruits all the time. And they had to put us through training, you know, to get, because they were also getting, you know, a lot of volunteers. In fact, and I was going to mention this to you because I think this is sort of interesting, because now in this small town, the population then, you know, maybe somewhere around 8,000 to 10,000.
In Northampton?
No, I'm back in Glasgow.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
All right. That's fine.
But I think I've always thought it was pretty interesting that there were about 14 girls that volunteered and went into the Navy. Now, they didn't go into Officer Candidate School, but they could have because most of them were college graduates.
And Officer and Candidate School was, what was that?
That's what I went into because I applied for that early, and they were, you know, because see, then you may have read this, but even at the end of the war, I think it was only about 250,000 women total waves all over the country, and that was a 3-year period. So, you know, it was not a big group at all in that respect.
Yeah,
but these girls went into other areas. Some of them were different things. One in Florida, she wasn't a pilot because you couldn't do that. But different, you know,
different areas. Okay, well, tell me about your experience up at Smith.
Oh,
tell me about a typical day during the training.
Well, gosh, if I can, every day was typical because you did the same thing every day.
I mean, it was boot camp.
Oh yeah, was boot camp. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, okay. You got up at 6 o'clock, I think it was, and then of course you had to have your bed, you know, you had bunk beds. The Navy had taken over and everything was shipshape.
Yeah.
And you had two people to the
bunk beds.
Bunk bed, yeah. And you had to have your sheet. This was a real experience. I learned how to really make up that bed with a tight sheet, you know, because the captain would come in to inspect and if he couldn't flip a quarter on your sheet, you got demerits. So you were sure you did that right. Oh, and then, you know, you had, you went out and you did, you marched and you did calisthenics and all of that, you know, for about an hour or so. And then they had wonderful meals, so wonderful, you wouldn't believe.
Oh, my goodness.
Because they, you know, they took it all over. And they were, so... And of course, we had classes all the time, and then you had tests and that kind of thing, and then you had lectures, and you know, just the.
Were the days exhausting?
They were. Well, you slept well, I guess you. But exhausting? I don't know. I never thought about it that way, really. The exhaustion came later, when you were on duty.
Okay.
Yeah, because this was just training, you know.
Uh-huh.
Oh, but the day that we graduated there was the hottest day in the world. And you know, Massachusetts can get
humid. It can get hot.
And
yep.
Hot. And so we were, you know, having the parade and all that business and standing out at attention on the field and all those things practically all day. 25 people passed out and had to be carried off, you know. So, but it... you know, it was just training. That's all I could say. And you had classes and a lot of things. One thing that really stuck in my mind, and I repeat this frequently to people, and I say I'm going to get up in front of a lot of people someday and say this, and they're going to shoot me down. They taught you things that you didn't ever think about, that you thought, well, sure, that's, everybody knows that. Like, you don't chew chewing gum in public, you know, and things that, I can't think about. Well, don't repeat this.
Try to turn the recorder off.
Things that that you thought everybody knew, uh-huh. You know, before you were ever. But I'm sure they had to gear it to, you know, all these things that people, might be one person out there that wouldn't know.
Well, I don't think today they know very well, right? All
that's
the gum smack
right.
going on.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
And wash your hands, you know, after. And things but primarily it was to teach you about a little bit, and it was, it had to be, you know, a very minimum, about, you'd have something about ships and, you know, what was going on in the war a little bit, you know, but very, very little on that.
And where did you go then after Smith? Before you answer that, let me just tell you that I am hearing your hands when you on here, okay?
Oh,
so, but you're fine.
Okay.
Just if you can remember. But if I touch you again.
That is very sensitive.
You know, well, if I touch you again, that's what that means, okay?
Okay, I'll try to remember. Okay.
So where did you go after Smith?
Okay, well, see, after Smith, you took a battery of tests while you were at Smith. And then look through all your testing to see where you would be going for active duty. And there were quite a number. In fact, I had a roommate then later who was in communications. Quite a few went into communications, and there were just the two different areas. And
communications and what else?
What did they call the other one? Can't think. Well, I don't know, because it was also divided, because I went into naval intelligence, and then you got your orders where you were to report that week, next week. And I was sent to D.C., to the naval station there, which was down on Constitution Avenue. Barracks that were there during World War I that were converted into a Navy building that was there, not barracks. They might have had some barracks, I don't know. But anyway, it was down on the reflection pool, between the Lincoln
Memorial
and the Washington
Monument.
Yeah. So after getting to Washington, and then, you know, you were put somewhere for 2 or 3 nights out and then you had to find a place to stay. Now, that was one difference that I found that I thought was really, you had to find your own quarters then. An officer had to. The enlisted personnel had barracks furnished. We had to
Rent your own room?
Rent our own, yeah. And we had to provide our own transportation. If you were over in the barracks, across the river in Virginia, you know, you had buses to take you.
And then you had your meals provided also in the barracks.
Yeah.
But you had to provide your own meals.
We had to do all that, yeah. That was, see, we got the same pay that a man would. We were treated the same way a man was.
Okay.
Which was part of it.
It's wonderful.
It was wonderful.
Especially
for
that time.
It really was, yeah. And so we didn't know discrimination in that respect at all. There wasn't any, you know, because we got the same. And finding a place to live in Washington during wartime is not what you want to have to do. Because we found a place right away, but it was way out. It took an hour on the bus every day going back. an hour down, an hour back, and a lot, about 3 miles, I guess. But in the...
You had a roommate then?
I didn't have a roommate. We had, most of us got these, it was a new, well, it's not exactly a subdivision because they had all these places to rent, Friendship Heights. It's almost on the Maryland border.
Right, okay.
And, but there were enough of us there that, you know, we could find a friend. And I did, fortunately.
So several of you.
Very good friends.
From yeah. Smith went to Washington at the
yeah.
same time.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There were, yeah, I don't know really how many, but I know that enough that, you know, we weren't alone.
Okay.
And you make friends then,
uh-huh.
which was great. And we stayed out there a while, but then you got tired of it, you know, too, because one little room, and then you had to eat all your meals, find your meals. So a friend and I decided we'd go out on our own. We went to the Y, and we thought, well, we'll just stay down there, because we'd given up our room.
In Washington, right in D.C.?
In D.C., uh-huh. yeah, out at Friendship Heights. This
okay.
was way out, but... We were going to find a room closer to the Navy building so we could walk. And besides that, let's see, I wasn't on shifts at that time, but she was, and she needed to. Because at night, at midnight, you know, traveling in way out or wherever, because Washington
Do they even have buses
was
way
not
at night?
A safe city. They had buses to a certain hour. Whether they had them all night, I'm not real sure. I don't know. I don't know how Fran really was going back and forth at night.
So did you find a room at the Y?
Well, we did, but, you know, we could only stay at 2 weeks. They put us out. They said, you've got to get out in 2 weeks' time. Well, by that time, let's see, I had been sent to, you know, you had your billet by then.
Your billet, what is that?
Billet, that's your, well, your... where your office would be,
okay.
where you'd be working.
Your station, basically.
Yeah,
yeah.
Your station, yeah. Navy term.
Yeah.
and I was sent to an art, group, and they were doing, making things for the fleet. Silhouettes, really, was what it amounted to. Silhouettes of the enemy ships and planes, and then making manuals from that so that they could be easily identified by our fleet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we were doing. And we had a top artist, Rolf Klepp, well-known at that time. And then I had a wonderful, wonderful friend. He's also well-known, an artist. See, because they were all artists in this department. And then not too many, just, maybe. And architects. Architects, of course, because, of, you know, the identification symbols had to be right. And so we were down there for, gosh, I stayed there. I got bored to tears. Because it was, I said, this is, you know... elementary school, what we're doing. But the fellas were, you know, they were working at it, and they were getting the manuals out, and we were doing the grunt work.
Which know, was?
Doing the silhouettes.
And just painting them by hand?
Oh, no,
with black
no,
ink,
you
or?
Did them with, you know, they had a graph paper,
okay.
that, and then you cut them out from that, I mean, with a scalpel, you know, X-Acto knife or whatever. And so you had to do all these little, you know, got old. But still you were learning a lot, too, because that was
and you would,
out how it works.
So you would do this from 9 to 5 every day?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 8 to 5.
8 to
we
5.
Didn't know. No 9 o'clock. 8. So that went on for several months, and I thought, you know, I can't go on with this. This war's going on and on. And I went up and talked to, as I told you, this commander who was over the women who were in ONI. Well, oh, wait a minute, I skipped part. I had to go to Naval Intelligence School over in Frederick, Maryland before I came back to D.C. I was in D.C., but I was sent to
sure.
Naval Intelligence
uh-huh.
School over there. Then, after, I've forgotten how many, that was Hood College that they took over there in Frederick, Maryland. And so when I came back, this was where I was, down in this group. And they were a great group. You know, that was great, but it did get
a little tedious.
A little bit tedious, yes, yes, to put it mildly. So when I went up then to this person who was the head of the waves in this, in ONI.
And this was a woman.
And this was a woman, thank goodness. And I told her my plight, which, you know, she understood, and thank heavens. And she was very, but now again, I mean, they're not, you know, overly understanding or overly sympathetic or anything like that. I don't mean to imply that, because it was all business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But she then, right away, it wasn't but just a very few weeks till she found this place for what was called the map room, opposite Op 16 FP. That's for Operations Foreign Plot. Well, so I've forgotten if they interviewed me or not. I guess they did, before they let me come into this office. But that's where I went, and it was very interesting. To me, it was very interesting, because we were really, we felt like we were doing something then.
You know,
and
what were
really
you doing?
Contributing. And not, I don't mean to minimize this other, because those manuals had to go out.
That was important.
That was important.
To be able to identify the enemy ships.
To the ones that were in training, yes. But this was, you know, a hands-on more sort of thing. So at,
and what was it?
It was, well, there were two rooms there. Well, actually, there were two rooms and a third big, huge room that was divided, because the maps were changed, well, sometimes daily. Maps of where we were bringing to the naval admirals and admiral. Well, now, when I first went in there, it was right at the time when Admiral Knox, he was there about 2 or 3 weeks and died. And then Admiral King came on. So actually, that's when most of the time he was there. I said that wrong. Secretary Knox.
Secretary King, then?
No, Secretary Forrestal came on. Admiral King, oh gosh, I hope I'm telling you that right. This has been a long
time.
Yeah. But I just remember seeing Knox, you know, for maybe a week or two when I was there. And he was not an admiral. He was secretary. That was, you know, during, see, Roosevelt was still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And Forrestal then came on as Secretary of the Navy.
And what's his name again? Forrestal?
Yeah.
Okay.
Forrestal.
Okay.
Now, I had the greatest respect for that man. He was all business. But I'll tell you how this worked.
Okay.
There we go. Every morning, the captain, now we had a captain in this office, a captain, two fellows, lieutenant commanders, a full lieutenant. One of them was lieutenant, was it lieutenant commander? Captain Bagley, and one of them was a lieutenant commander, and one was a full lieutenant.
And what were you?
I was, at that time, see, the Navy goes up according to service, your length of service.
But you were an officer.
But not like the Army. See, they're appointed by the superior officer.
Okay.
That's not true in the Navy.
Okay.
If you serve a certain length of time, then you're
automatically
advanced.
Advanced?
You're automatically advanced, unless, of course, you know, there's a problem.
Right.
So I think I was, I guess I must have been by that time a Lieutenant JG. That's Lieutenant Junior Grade. and then you go to full lieutenant. See, the rank's different too in the Army. Because you go in as an ensign and you serve, it must be about a year at that time. They might have, you know, made it less too. I don't recall on that.
So when you finished Smith College, you were an ensign?
Yes. Okay. You get your stripes when you're graduated there.
Okay.
Then you are an ensign for maybe a year, maybe a year and a half. It must have been a year and a half, I would think. And then you go up to Lieutenant JG.
Okay, so you think you were a Lieutenant JG at this point?
Yeah, I think so. I'm pretty sure I was. Yeah.
So there were three of you anyway?
There were those three fellas, and they were back in the inner sanctuary. Now, out front, you had your desk, and see, there were three WAVE officers, and we worked shifts. Now, if you've never worked shifts, that's called the Battle of the Shifts. Believe me, it is, because they were tough. And you changed every 3 days. You went from...
So there were three shifts?
Three shifts, and you changed seat. And then at night, of course, the women, you had a yeoman who was a WAVE. Each officer had a yeoman and a Marine armed guard.
Now, a yeoman did clerical work,
right? That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then the Marine armed guard, of course, was a male. And he was there all the time, always, right by your desk.
Huh.
Because, see, there was so much secret information that was coming in there. And so it was important, especially on that night shift.
Okay, so what did you do?
So what we did was, well, we took off all the information that was coming from. We were in constant contact that way with the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, as SHAEF, which was General Eisenhower's. He was in command of that in Europe. And then the Pacific, when we, you know, were in the Pacific then, that was MacArthur's headquarters, and his communiques always came in General MacArthur's headquarters. Eisenhower never mentioned his name, but Eisenhower was always General Eisenhower's headquarters, of course, in the Pacific. And I was going to mention something else about the...
Were you saying you were in constant communication?
Yeah, because we just had at that time, see, we got communiques always on the ticker tape. What was happening particularly in the early days of Europe, you know, not early days, by then it was much later, because it was in 44. We were into 44 by then. And so there was tremendous amount of activity.
And so when you say that you're getting this information, you're talking about battles that were occurring?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And see, then, and I have not told you this yet, the map room, see, because this is foreign plot, Operation Foreign Plot. So we had all these maps, which were the map itself would go on slide. We had all these sliding panels, which would be the size of that wall and a little bit longer, that would, you know, we'd have to. And that's what we did during the night. And if we were on, in the late afternoon, see, because that we had to change the maps constantly.
So these are maps of Germany and maps of France and maps
exactly.
of North Africa. And big maps, small maps, maps of towns,
you'd have a town like, some little town around here, like Winchester, uh-huh. That would cover this entire area, and a certain section maybe of Winchester would be blown up, would be that size. Because when they, like, you know, in the Battle of the Bulge particularly, that was one area that was very, very difficult, and you needed the small areas to show. See?
Because it covered a large area, and you needed to be able to focus on small maps to show detail?
Where you could get the detail, it would be blown up,
the size of a wall.
To the size that you needed. Because if you had one infantry group caught in that place, there was much that they needed to know. Now, when I say they needed to know, let me explain to you what I mean. Because every morning, see, this was set up like a theater, mm-hmm. For the maps, and then elevated. There were about, I guess, maybe 15 seats that were in the back, where the captain then gave the briefing when the admirals from the fleet were in to Washington, which different ones came in all the time,
okay.
Like Bull Halsey and Nimitz and, he was such a gentleman. He was so nice. Bull Halsey, you know where he got his name, and he was that. But when they were in town, they would come in to get this briefing because they needed to know what was happening in Europe. And, they've been out here on a ship or somewhere, and they don't...
Right.
And so that was what our room, our office was for, to brief the Secretary of the Navy who came in, if he was there.
So were you in
most
these briefings?
Every day.
Were you in the briefings?
We were there to bring in the big boys. So we didn't get to stay in the room. We had to stay outside.
You would show the admirals in, and then you would leave.
Well, we had to stay outside to see who was coming in, see, because sometimes someone would come in late or, different things. And it would have probably been degrading to the admirals had these little waves come in to hear it. Well, and besides, of course, all this was secret. You couldn't, we had access to it, certainly, but...
So did you draw the maps? Is that what you were doing?
Oh, no. Oh, I'm sorry. I need to explain to you. These were maps that were sent to us from over at the Pentagon. See, they would do the maps.
Right. Okay.
And they would have them so that certain areas that were going to be coming up, they could, get those ready, send them over, and they were in sections. Now, I'm using my hands too much. Well, I'll say maybe those sheets were probably about 18 by 18. And we had to put
18
them,
inches by 18 inches?
Yeah, uh-huh. And see, we had to put them together and put them on the boards so that the boards could be...
So no overhead projectors. These were just pieces of paper that you had to put
paper,
together.
Yeah, that the captain could, diagram and point to and show what was going on.
Okay. So you were able to see these maps then?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, see, we had to get those maps ready the night before. Yeah, when we were on that. See, our shift, that shift was, we came on at, 7 o'clock in the morning and stayed till 9 o'clock we overlapped the night shift stayed the 12 o'clock to 9 o'clock. See, that was one shift, 12 o'clock to 9. And then we overlapped on that shift from, we must have come on at 7 those mornings, because we overlapped 2 hours there to be sure that we got the latest information and that it was plugged in and that it was all on that map.
Okay.
Well, but see, you had a series of maps. You didn't have just one.
Sure. That, okay.
Of course, it was, and the boards, you throw one off and bring another one on that morning.
Map, you mean?
As it was going, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The so panels, you would. So
the panels were. We had probably 6 panels that we'd have to.
So the maps were affixed to the panels, and the panels would be removed?
Sliding.
And other
they were sliding,
sliding panels.
So
you'd move one panel over and pull out another map.
And bring on the next one, right. Yeah.
But the maps then stayed on the panels once you put them on?
Well, they'd stay on just for that, if when the operation changed, the maps changed, and it could change or it could stay on.
Okay.
You know, a night or maybe three or four nights, it depended on however long. So that's what, you know, it was a pretty busy night.
Okay, so yeah, 18 by 18, so you had quite a few maps, pieces of map to put together.
Yeah, that you had to put together, yeah. Yeah, they were mostly that small because that was really easier to handle, to get the area that you needed. Because if they got too big, it was more difficult.
So how often would these briefings occur?
Every morning.
Okay, so you were busy constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, you were changing maps all the time.
Oh, yeah,
okay.
Right. If something was going on. You know, but then if there was nothing happening, or sometimes, you know, maybe you didn't have to move the entire thing, but mostly yes. You know, it was changing as long as, you know, battles were going on, which there were.
Okay, and different admirals were
coming. And landings, yeah. You know, and of course, D-Day.
Well, so tell me, what was your longest day? What would have been your longest or most difficult day in the Navy?
There are a lot of long ones. there really were, because there were, you know, crises, and we got that first. The Secretary Forrestal, I want to tell you about him,
okay.
too, because he was such a character. It's an interesting, interesting man, and you felt all the time, every morning, he never smiled. He came in, and he never, ever smiled. He was a driven man, you could tell. You know, and that certainly, because he finally was at Bethesda. This was after the war now, several years after the war, but he committed suicide. He was just, I'm sure, he just gave you that feeling, you know, that nothing else is important but this. When he would come in the mornings. Oh, I know what, you asked me my longest day. My most memorable day, I guess, was, it was long. It was the longest walk I ever took. And the building where we were office, the old quarters, were across the reflection pool, and there was a walkway, you know, over the reflection pool, over to the main building on Constitution Avenue. And that's where Secretary Forrestal had his office. And on Christmas Day, this was during the Battle of the Bulge. And I would, you know, everybody that could was home. And I got to duty. I was not at home, I was on duty. And about 10 o'clock, I guess it was about 10 o'clock, I don't know. And only the ones there were, I was there, and my yeoman was there, and my armed guard. And here came this beeper, you know, Secretary Forrestal wants you to come down to his office and report on what's happening, Battle of the Bulge. Well, see, this was, I don't know how familiar you are with that.
Well, that was
that battle.
That was the biggest land battle of World War II.
It was the turning point.
And it was December 1944.
Yeah. It was Christmas Day. Christmas, I think it was Christmas Day, not Christmas Eve. I think it was Christmas Day. But walking across that reflection pool, across the walk over there, was the longest walk I ever took in my life. I was scared to death. I know. Oh, gosh, what if I don't tell it just like it is, if I get it messed up, you know? What infantry? No. Which one's there? Who's there? What's going on? And how? Or where are the Germans?
And, you know? Did you have just all this information in your head, or did you have...
Oh, I had to.
I mean, you didn't have notes, or...
Well, I didn't. Oh, no, because, okay. See, he just wanted that, what's happening right now. So I just had to read it and go, you know. What I could, and try to, and as I told you, I think maybe that's why I felt that this man is driven. He is so driven. And
so what was that like facing him?
Well, he was fine. He didn't communicate about it. He didn't detain you. He was all, well, of course he was, you know.
So tell me the process. You made that long walk and you went into the door. What happened?
I just reported, you know, first thing you do, and I wish that president we got, excuse me, you may be all for him, but I wish he'd learn how to salute. He's got the sloppiest salute I ever saw. He don't have business having a salute anyway, draft dodger. Excuse me.
It's okay. Go right ahead.
You don't have to, but because, you know, well.
You're not alone.
Well, I don't mind saying it. I think, you know, I gave 3 years of my life in the service of this country. I am not about to apologize for the way I feel about him. Anyway, so, you know, that's the first thing you do, of course.
You walk
salute
in the room and
an
salute.
Officer,
yeah.
Or salute a higher ranking officer. And I said, you know, Lieutenant Howard reporting. For you, that's what you always do, so you tell me exactly. And then I went on with all I could come up with. And thank goodness it was then instead of now. I would have been scared to death, you know. And
you did okay.
I got it. Well, as far as I know, I wasn't demoted anyway. So.
And how long did that take then? How long were you in his office?
Oh, I was probably there. I don't know. He probably asked me a few questions, you know, too, about certain divisions or something that was there, and maybe I don't recall. I was too numb, but it was an experience for me. So that was my big experience, I guess, in that respect. Now, there were a lot of experiences. You couldn't be there. You couldn't. Well, nobody could be in Washington without experiences.
Yeah.
You know,
anytime. Well, what did it feel like to be getting these maps and seeing what was going on? How did that impact on you?
Oh, gosh, did it ever. It really did. And I'll tell you this. The real thing, see, you know, I don't know. How much you studied, and I don't know how much is even in history books today about World War II, but, you know, Japan had occupied the Chinese coast,
mm-hmm.
and we were then, after, now this is after, of course, after VJ Day, and we were preparing for, see, this must have been in July then, it had to be, the invasion of China, that we were, you know, we had the maps. They'd already sent them over. And we were already putting them on the panels
uh-huh.
for the invasion of China. See, when, it was in August. Had to be August. Oh, because that was such, because I was on leave then and I'd gone to Canada with this friend. And we heard about it. Coming down from Montreal, Quebec down to Montreal, that bomb had been dropped. Oh gosh, what a chilling thing!
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sure it affected everybody that way. It couldn't be any other way. Of course, you weren't even thought about being born by then, but it was. It was quite. And we were on the train all day long, and we got to New York, and everything was. Well, the next day it was when we got to New York, and everything was just, unbelievable. Because it was so, the whole town, the whole city was just, that was all that was happening, you know.
Everyone talking about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And what was that going to happen next, of course, till the next, and then. So, anyway, the maps, back to the maps. It had to be August when we were doing all these maps. And not knowing, still, what the bombs were, what was going to happen from the bombs.
Right, okay.
So we were still, you know, doing that.
So you're preparing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was just a great happening. That's all I can say. What I don't mean dropping the bombs. I still feel very, you know, that's a, you have mixed emotions.
Yeah.
You can't have anything else. But also, I have great respect and admiration for that president. He was, to make a decision like that, that he was, Truman was a, he was a real person with, could exercise judgment. Because look at the lives it saved.
The end of the war?
It ended the war. It destroyed a lot of lives. That's the horror of
that
it.
That is the horror of it.
Yeah. But I have learned, and I probably never would have otherwise, since we've worked with the Japanese so much, and you know, we have about 15 of them here working with
at
us.
Great
and have had. We've worked with them for quite a long time now. And that's another story. when they first came over and when we first, you know, started. I don't mean when they first came over. I mean when they first came into our part of the world.
After the war, you mean?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I respect them, really.
Well, tell me a little bit about that. I mean, you're the founder of a large construction company, and you've been working with Japanese. What was, talk about that a little
the
bit.
The relationship?
Yeah.
Well, at first, because, well, gosh, I wish I could tell you the date when we first started working with them. Stephen was real young, so it's been a long time. Must have been 70, in the
early
70s,
uh-huh.
maybe 74 or 5. Jimmy can tell you exactly because he was the one who first, you know, introduced our company to the Japanese and got information and found out from a trading company how to, you know, how we could go about trying to make contacts.
And you're talking about then
the
doing
Japanese.
Construction jobs in Japan?
No, in this country.
Okay.
No, we couldn't have dared do that.
Okay.
Now, that's not like Austin. I mean, you know, they are or what, but we see, and particularly that long ago, we were regional.
Okay.
Then.
So Japanese coming into Kentucky with their businesses, when did Toyota come
see,
in?
Well, our first job, well now this was before Toyota.
Okay.
Because Jimmy, this trading company was in New York, and he contacted this fellow there. And then three of them came down to Glasgow. Our first job was down in Lebanon, Tennessee with, not Sony, but,
Mitsubishi?
Mm-hmm. Another one. Toshiba. Yeah, it was Toshiba. They were looking at, because, you know, they are really a smart, smart group. And they came to Glasgow then after a few contacts. I don't know how many times Jimmy had met with them. Or
and
what.
Jimmy's
I
your
don't
son.
Recall. Yeah, you don't know Jimmy.
I do know, but just for
but
the sake
just,
of the interview.
Anyway, Jimmy. And so we were all at the office. Now, this was, Stephen was about 7 maybe. And when we found out they were coming that night for dinner. Well, at that time, see, I was working at the office every day. And Stephen was would come out in the afternoons because after school because he had to. And I had some help at the house in the daytime, but she worked at night. She had previously been there at dinner time, but not after we had to change everything, after things changed, after James Norris died, and, you know, it was, and I was at the office every day. And so I thought, oh gosh, what will I have for dinner? What can I do? What can I do?
And so the office at that time was in Glasgow?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't fill you in on these things. Thank you. And Howard was there. Jimmy was there. I guess they were the only two then, because others were all away in school.
Yeah, Howard is the oldest, or is Franklin the older?
No, Howard's oldest.
Okay.
Well, there's a daughter who's the oldest,
oh, okay.
And then Howard, and then Jimmy, and then Franklin. And then another daughter, and then Stephen, and they were only two at home at that time. Well, Jimmy wasn't even at home; he was in college in Nashville at Vanderbilt, and but he'd come home on the weekends to work with the company because we were, you know, pretty struggling, and so anyway, we were all there at the house. I went out to my house for dinner, and here were these three Japanese. Not a one of them could speak English. Here we were, not a one of us could speak any Japanese.
Oh,
you can imagine. The conversation was very strange. strange, because we all did a lot of smiling, a lot of laughing, and that was all we could do. But anyway, that was, apparently they didn't mind too much, because when Jimmy would meet with them in New York, and then, or when they then later would come down, they'd bring an interpreter, thank goodness. So then it did all go well, and we got this job. That was our first Japanese job, and we really, really have been very, very fortunate to have gotten to work with these people and know them and appreciate them. Now, several times, it took me several years, really, and several times I have wondered what to say, and when we were, you know, working with them a lot more and having more being able to entertain them better.
Mm-hmm.
And one time I know in particular, and I was sitting next to the CEO who had come over from Tokyo at the dinner table.
The CEO of Mitsubishi?
No.
Of Toshiba?
I don't remember which job it was. We have worked with them for so long. No, this was another company.
Okay.
But through the years, you know, because we have worked with many companies. And some way it came up, because it's hard not to, especially when you were still just a few, relatively few years away from the war, to ignore it, you know. And so it was.
So some of these gentlemen were vets themselves, probably.
I was with one in Tokyo that was, yes. In fact, one who was on a submarine at Pearl Harbor.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And you talked about it.
Yeah, through the interpreter.
And how did that conversation go?
Well, I'll tell you how. He explained that he came to this country. He was an architect, and his father had an architectural company there. And we were working with them, and we were entertained royally in Tokyo, because
so this was in the mid-70s?
It was, no, it was later than that. It was in the 80s.
Okay.
It was in the 80s. But he was able, you know, to talk about it freely.
And what did he say?
He came to this country soon after the war because they had not been ravaged, I guess, and they still had plenty of, they were wealthy people.
And his family.
His family, yeah. And quite a few of them had mm-hmm. to be, you mm-hmm. know, because they kept their companies. A lot of them did. Well, most of them did. I don't know. Some of them probably didn't. But anyway, he said he stayed and traveled for 15 months. He traveled all over. And if you traveled, if you were in, I don't know, I was in Europe and I was in Asia, but soon after, not too soon afterward, it was probably, you know, like 15 years after, always longer than that, after the war, much longer, because after the children were, you know, out from the house, and except for Stephen, he always had to go, because he was too little. they travel in mass. I know you've seen them.
Sure, the Japanese tourists, yeah.
Because they were learning everything. They are really smart people.
Mm-hmm.
And they were taking it all in everywhere.
But you said this gentleman talked about the war.
Because he had traveled so widely and accepted these things. He didn't make any big conversation about it at all, but just mentioned it.
I see.
That was...
That he was on a sub in Pearl Harbor?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what was your reaction when he said that?
Oh, my gosh, you know. I was just dumbfounded, you know. But he was the kind of person that, you know, I think after the war, they can take it and learn from it,
mm-hmm.
which is terribly important.
Yeah.
And still negotiate, you know, with the companies that defeated them. And that's, I think it's
much different.
I don't know, because we haven't dealt with the Germans that much. But, and of course, Japan's just such a different country.
The culture is different.
A homogeneous country.
Than a European country.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just totally different.
Well, they have such a different system of culture of honor.
Oh yes.
And for
yes. Which is absolutely something that we could all aspire to. You know,
yeah.
We did. I must tell you this. Our first job, this job I'm telling you about, when neither of us spoke the other language, got. Do you think we had lawyers all around? No. Of course they're. They don't like lawyers to begin with, but I can understand why, because of this system of honor that they revere. And we did our first job on a handshake. Now, that's true.
Wow.
And yeah.
And
I wish we had a photo of it.
And it went forward fine.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't need the lawyers.
Well, and it's yes, that's right. That's right. Much, much easier to work with. Much easier. And so I think that's interesting. They could tell you more about that. I don't know if they got a photo of that. I hope Howard did, but I don't know.
Wow.
Because that's something you never hear of today.
Yeah.
So that's for sure.
Huh.
But it was...
Well, let me just check here to see if there are any other... Well, this one, you know, some men, we mentioned this before, but some men in the Navy were resentful of women coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Did you face
mm-hmm.
that resentment?
I did. I don't know that I've ever even told this before. Except she went away. She wasn't away. She was in drama.
Okay, well, let me ask that question again. Some men in the Navy were resentful of women coming in and taking their jobs.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you one thing. When we were looking, this roommate that I had, after the Y, after we couldn't stay there any longer, they didn't allow us to stay over 2 weeks, and we didn't know where we were going. And we'd go up and down the streets, and one of the fellas that was in my first office, who was a dear, wonderful friend, he and his wife both, and he would go in the afternoons with us if we were off, if we got off on the shift that came off at 3 o'clock. I'm not sure on these dates. I mean these hours, but I think that's right. To look for a place, because there would be signs in the yards, no wax, no waves, no dogs.
Oh my goodness.
So Harry Devlin, this guy would, he was wonderful. And he, you know, trying to help us out. And if you go with a man long in uniform, we you know, he thought, well, maybe this will help you out.
Uh-huh. You know. And did it?
Well, we lived in 16 places in Washington, D.C.
And how long of a time?
Well, it was Fran. She finally ended up in Bethesda because the shifts like that are really difficult. I mean, I sympathize with anybody on that kind of. And anyway, she had to stay in Bethesda for months. And I felt horrible, just horrible, because you don't eat right, you don't sleep right, and then that's what happens to you, you know. So
we had this officer, gentleman officer, with you.
Oh, yeah, trying to help us find a place. But even that, you know, we would have found a place to stay, but you're still still looking. But we had, for various reasons, we had to leave different places. We had to, one time, bed bugs and, you know, just these things that happen. I can't begin to tell you.
On the job, did you face resentment?
Yes. When I say on the job, not necessarily on the job as much as, because these fellows were really the ones that I knew, like the one I'm telling you about, mm-hmm. He was great. And they were, if you got to knowing them that well and working with them, they were.
They were fine.
Yeah, I didn't face any on the job, that.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to sick bay, it was very, very obvious because they just turned you off like nothing's wrong, you know. And I was about to, you know.
Just, so you were sick?
Yeah, I was sick. I was anemic. That was really what was wrong. But
and they just treated it very casually?
Like it was nothing, you know. And finally, they sent me to another doctor. They sent me to, I didn't tell this for a long time, but to a psychiatrist. Now, this was a medical doctor that sent me to a psychiatrist because the medical doctor didn't want to fool with me, you know. They just wanted to pass you off to someone else, forget it, you know. And everything was wrong. When I got, this guy was also a medical doctor as well.
Uh-huh.
And he immediately, I mean, I wasn't in there 30 minutes, still he said, there's nothing wrong with you. You need to get off shifts for a while, you know, because it was just absolutely, it just wrecks your system. And
so were you able to do that and get off shifts?
Yeah, because he saw to it.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. But that was, it was with the, and I also had that to happen because, you know, you pick up things. And I got with somebody that was with the American Red Cross. And I had this terrible, I was sick as I could be. I'd gotten, at the Willard Hotel. You know the old Willard Hotel.
I've lived in Washington, but I don't know that.
Well, it's been rejuvenated, but it was good then. But I got food poisoning. And fortunately, I had this cousin who was with the American Red Cross. In fact, she was head of the Eastern Division to send them. They had to all come through her office to be screened and to be determined whether or not they mm-hmm. could serve overseas. And so Margaret lived over in Alexandria, and I'd spend weekends over there frequently. So I was so sick, and I called him, Margaret, I'm about to die. What can I do? And she said, come over here. And she called the fella with the Red Cross there, and he said, to call somebody in the Navy, which she did. And she told him, you know, that I had fever about 100, way up there, 105 or something, you know, felt horrible. And you know what they told her?
What'd they tell her?
Said, well, tell her to come in Monday. She won't die. I mean, you know, that makes you feel good.
Oh, my gosh.
but that was, that I'm only telling those stories because they do remain pretty vivid because it was war.
Yeah. A different kind of war. That was even a different kind of war. I mean, mm-hmm. just dealing with that mm-hmm. resentment and
yeah.
sexual
yeah, but
harassment.
I was fortunate. And then, oh, then after that, I was, really, I went on vacation. The war was over. And so, of course, as soon as the war was over, they started all this dismantling, which, of course, had to happen right away.
Uh-huh.
As soon as possible. And I went to, I got sent down to Fort Lauderdale to Naval Air Station, and at Hollywood Beach Hotel, and had a nice little apartment right on the ocean, little, you know. And of course, there was nothing for you to do, you know. But you had to serve, see, till your time was up.
Yeah.
And till they, and of course, they had to get the ones that had been serving overseas for longer,
they
home
first
mm-hmm. and they should have, certainly. So they did, of course, that took priority. And so you were there till your number came up,
uh-huh.
which, and it was, so I was down there for, gosh, it was a vacation, that's all it was, and 3 months. And then, oh, and the captain would have down there, see, he was regular Navy, of course, and he would have a cocktail party every twice a week, and you were expected to be there, you know. And so it was that kind of place.
Wow.
I don't know if you need to tell that.
Well, okay, but I have one last question for you then. I mentioned this on the phone, but what did being in the Navy during World War II mean to you? And what does it mean to you today?
Today? At the time, I was ready to get out. 3 years was enough. And you could stay in if you wanted to. And one of my dear friend, she was a bit older than I, but she still lives in Maine. And when I'm up there in the summer, I always try to go see her. And, oh, wonderful person. Now, she stayed in. She went up as high as she could go because she was very competent. And Mary was, she's a great person. But I was ready to get out. It was enough. But I had to go to another place before I could get out, because I didn't get out until February of 1946. Because of your time, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, are you glad you served?
Oh, I wouldn't take anything for the experience. And yes, and I have a great deal of pride in having done it, if that makes sense
yes,
to you. I'm not,
it certainly does. How did it impact your life?
I think it's probably, as I tell people, maybe I said this to you, I think I did. I got my PhD in the Navy, 3 years in the Navy after.
You felt like you had your PhD when you finished, you mean?
No kidding. I'm no kidding. Yes, sir. That was I'm not I'm not as emotional as you think. It's allergies. But I think might be both. But anyway, I guess, you know, you never thought about it too much for a long time. But then, seeing with children growing up, I do think about it, and I guess I bring it up too much. They probably get, because recently I have really felt, you know, this, we need to talk about this. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm so glad you're doing this, Amy, because these fellows, I want you to get to talk to them.
Well,
because
it's been
they've
fascinating.
All had really, and they all have very good, very varied experiences, not good experiences, a lot of them, but experiences that are unforgettable. And there's no way today that you can really transmit these things to, you know, this is three generations back, mm-hmm. and you can't transmit that.
Has the 50th anniversary had an impact on you?
Oh, did it ever? Yes. And I thought, Jimmy was in London, and he kept calling me, why didn't you come over here? I thought, why didn't I? You know, I sat there watching it and thinking, oh, gosh. But I'll tell you what I did do afterward. About 2 years ago, I guess, three maybe, I took two grandchildren, two daughters, granddaughters, both about, how old were they then? About 13, I guess. Good period to take children. And a granddaughter, I mean, two granddaughters and one daughter-in-law, Stephen's wife, before she had any children. And I thought, well, this would be a good trip for them. And I was going to be on a painting workshop down in Languedoc. You been down there?
No, I have not.
On the Spanish border.
Okay.
In France. Wonderful. And so we were down there for about a week and then went up to Provence to Saint-Rémy for another week and then to Paris. And when we were in Paris, I said, now, okay, we're going to take one day. We are going to Normandy because I want you all to be there and see this. I don't want you to know, this means.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. And I wouldn't take anything for it. I don't know. I think, I'm sure that one granddaughter really, it made an impression on her because she had studied about it when she was in school. They lived in Baltimore.
So this was before the 50th anniversary?
No, it was afterward.
Okay.
It was just about 3 years ago.
Okay.
The 50th was... Well,
was
about 4 to 5 years ago.
45,
then,
or
yeah, 95, this is right? Mm-hmm. So this must have been 3 years ago. Let's see, how was Carter? Yeah, it was 3 years ago because Lisa was pregnant and we didn't know it at the time. But she didn't know it, I don't think, until she got back. But
and so what did it mean to you,
well,
seeing Normandy?
To me?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. It's...
What did you feel when
it's,
you saw
it's
it?
It's really not describable. I don't have the words to describe it because, you know, you think, I wonder if this is one of the boys I knew, mm-hmm. you know, in school with,
uh-huh.
that, and or somebody from Glasgow that, now there are, listen, these are allergies. Oh, gosh. It does.
Yeah.
It really, really hits you. And I think one little granddaughter, because she had, I'm sure she'd heard me, you know, talking about it or heard her mother talking to her about it. But when she was in Baltimore and they were studying World War II, and I was disturbed because of the what she was learning from it, because it was so... And I do have a thing with that, that it's not the true story of the ones that came in late, the ones that weren't, I haven't really said this, and I don't quite know how to say it, Amy. The ones that lived in Europe and were really, had a terrible time.
Mm-hmm.
Understand it in a different way than the way we do.
Mm-hmm.
But when you see those crosses, you know, and then I heard somebody the other day remind me, and see, when we were going to school, because World War I was still being taught, I mean, when I was in grade school and
mm-hmm.
then, and you know, you had to memorize in Flanders Field. You probably don't even know what that
is.
No,
I don't.
It was a poem that was written right after World War I. In Flanders Field, the poppies grow, in mid the crosses row on row.
Okay. I think I have heard that.
Yeah, you probably heard it, but it's not, you know.
I didn't memorize it, that's
it
for
was,
sure.
Well, then it was really, you know, very moving. It still is, because I heard someone just the other day on the radio quoting it, you know. And I am giving you but two lines of it. But that's the impact. And, of course, that all came right back to me then, because you see those crosses. The poppies weren't blooming because we were in Normandy at the wrong time. But
sentiment was the same.
It's the same. That was what came to my mind there, because... and then you see, you know, unknown, and you think, oh, my God, oh, what mother, you know, what mother is...
wondering.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing that really...
Or at this point, what son or one child is wondering.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Grown mm-hmm. son now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's a very moving experience, really. But it's not for everybody, you know. Mm-hmm. Because then I ask, but one of them that was alone. Now this one that I'm telling you about, who had me to come over in my uniform and speak to her class in fourth grade in Baltimore, uh-huh. because I was disturbed about the what they thought, because they thought the whole war was just the Holocaust. Now, don't misunderstand me. That was horrible.
That was
horrible.
But it was just a part of it.
And certainly, because some of my best friends, we grew up with all kinds of diversity in the little town where we grew up. Thank goodness, because we knew that. We had a number of Russian Jews, one whose father had walked across Europe to escape. And, you know, you grew up with it. We had, so.
But you were bothered in particularly, why were you bothered?
Because that was the only part of it that she understood, that she knew anything, didn't understand. It was the only part that had been taught to her, the only part she knew. She thought that was all of it. Okay. She didn't know that there were, other people involved too, and that there were other people not treated that way.
And so you went to this class?
To the class and told them about experiences during World War II, yeah. Because she wanted me to, and her mother wanted me to. And so when that teacher was not teaching in class, she was somewhere else, because I wasn't, I didn't mean to be infringing in that manner, and wasn't. And I didn't promote it anyway. They were the ones that had done it, because I think it should be taught also that there was another, quite a few other countries into it that were certainly suffered.
Yes.
Too. Yeah. And gosh, Austria, have you ever lived in Austria?
No, just Italy, and I was a young girl. Italy. I was 8 years old.
You were?
I was a little girl.
Yeah, but you got a good...
I got a good feel of Italy.
Yeah.
Northern Italy, we were outside.
You were?
Outside Milano.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was good. That was a great experience for you.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it taught me that there was Europe. I mean, I was 8 years old. I didn't really know what Europe was.
Yeah, much less, but today it means a lot to you.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. And, they're not too young to travel. I went.
Well, I'm finished.
So, good. Thank you very much.
Well, I feel like I've taken...